Hello, I'm Paul Harrop.
Hello, I'm Kev Russell.
And I'm Helen Jeremy. And we're going to be talking about really small things you can find at Brisbane Botanic Gardens, Mount Coother. In this podcast from the Friends of Brisbane Botanic Gardens and Sherwood Arboretum, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Mount Coother Gardens. There's always something to catch your eye in the gardens, and with a million visitors a year, I wonder how many photos are taken, especially in this digital age where we're not stuck with our 12 items from the film. People will be taking landscapes, a flower which might pop out, perhaps an encounter with a dragon, that's a water dragon, or personal moments like selfies with their friends, and the kids playing around with the ducks down at the lily ponds. And this is mostly all done on phones, but you do see some people with cameras. If you go to the gardens on the weekend, and you may have seen early in the morning at opening time, a bunch of photographers bent over plants with cameras which have funny hoods on them, and they're macro photographers. And I've got to admit, I am one. And that's how I met today's guests. Kevin and Paul have been taking macro photos in the gardens for years, and they're going to tell us about a whole world that we normally don't notice. Even if you're not interested in photography, I think they're going to inspire you to, next time you're at the gardens, just stop and have a look and try to see some small things. Well, welcome to you both. You've had such a long association with the gardens. How did that arise, Paul?
I was a former primary school teacher and got tired of doing the job, as lots of teachers do. And about 22 years ago now, I left teaching and applied for a job at the Botanic Gardens as an education officer. I ended up getting the job, which I thought was highly unusual because I'm not a plant person and I didn't know a lot about plants, but they were looking for someone with teaching skills and computer skills. And I had to learn what I had to learn for the botanical side of working at the gardens to work with the school children. And one of our lessons was called Inspect Insects. And we used to take the year two children around the gardens looking at the different life stages of insects in the plants. And over a number of years, I found that these insects were really interesting. Some of them, like the native bees, are very beautiful insects. And after a while, I thought, I'd really love to take photographs of these insects. So I joined a group called Brisbane Bug Snappers, which is a macro photography group. And from there, I delved into the world of macro photography, which when you first start out, is extremely difficult. and that's how I got started into macro photography. And that's where I met Kev.
Yes, hi, I'm Kev Russell. I've been going to the gardens now since about 2010. I went with a mentor of mine in the early days that taught me everything he knew about macro photography, and what better place to do it than at Mount Coother Botanical Gardens. I started doing macro photography way back in 1968, so that was a pretty early start, and the equipment I used way back then was pretty basic, and with reverse rings, and reverse lenses on cameras, no flash, things like that. It was pretty ordinary. But with the new macro photographers in the DSLR days, everything sort of changed. And I've just honed my skills since 2010 and got to the point where I am now with macro photography. I love taking photos of mainly spiders. As Helen would know, and as Paul would know, if we find a spider, it's mine. Once it's in my viewfinder, it's recorded, forever for posterity. I love my macro photography, and at my age of 80-year-old, there's nothing much else I'd rather do than go to the gardens and take photos of spiders.
Well, the name macro, I think, can be a bit misleading for people. So, Paul, can you give us an idea about why is it called macro photography when we're taking little things?
Well, macro usually means large, doesn't it? And I suppose technically it should be micro photography. But Kip, I don't know why they call it macro. Do you know why they use that term, even though macro means larger?
Yes, macros, it's a really funny term for macro photography, or it really is micro photography, as you say, Helen.
But is it macro because you're trying to use all of the sensor?
Possibly that's where it comes from, because the idea is to fill the frame, isn't it? Yeah. And we don't tend to do the really close-up photography, the really heavy-duty macro photography, where you can see a creature's head and every aspect of its eye and mouth. We tend to just come back a little bit, and I like to see a background in my macro photography so that the picture actually tells a bit of a story. So technically, we're probably doing more close-up photography rather than really, really heavy-duty macro photography. That's the way I look at it anyway. And I think you're similar, Kev, aren't you? You like to get some of the background in there.
Yes, at least. I like to try and fill the frame as much as I can with the insect that I'm taking a photo of. If the background is close enough, it'll come out with a different colour, but it will be slightly blurry. But if there's nothing in the background, you end up with a black background. Yep. And that's just what happens with macro or close-up photography.
The major camera manufacturers are now making quite sophisticated macro lenses, but you don't really need to get all this expensive gear to be able to do it. Now that a lot of the modern point-and-click cameras have macro functions, which are really decent, and even the later model phones now have got great macro modes to use. And if you have an old macro, an old phone, you can even just buy a cheap clip-on to put over your lens to magnify things. So if you're interested in getting to know the bugs, you don't have to go out and buy all this equipment. Now, what really interests me is how many years that you've both returned basically every few weeks to go to the gardens at Mount Cutha to do your macro insect photography. And why do you keep going back there? What is it that sets the gardens apart? But, you know, particularly, say, for you, Kev, where you come from out of town.
Yeah, that's my main place to go for macro photography because of the variety of insects that you can get there. There's so many different insects to take photos of. And there's so many different areas at Mount Cutha Botanical Gardens that you find different types of insects in different areas. And it just keeps us coming back.
I suppose it's the variety of plants, isn't it, which helps. I recall reading once, I think the description is something like insects as specialist feeders, and that something like, and I don't know if I've got the statistic right, but something like 90% of insects feed on only one or a few plants. So to have a variety of insects, you need a great variety of plants, and that's what you can find at the Mount Cutha Gardens.
Yeah, well, that's true. It's the variety of plants and the abundance of flowering plants at the gardens, in the sensory garden and down the back in the temperate garden. The flowering plants do attract a lot of the insects that we are after, and because the flowering plants will attract bees and other and hoverflies and those sorts of insects, that's also where a lot of the spiders are. The predators are there as well.
Yes.
So your jumping spiders and those things are in those areas as well. That's why we tend to like the botanic gardens. That variety of plants and large areas of flowering plants.
So the sensory gardens, they're the ones where you come out of the information centre and you turn right and up the hill a little bit, and they've got lots of like plants like salvias, haven't they?
Salvias, so, yes. A lot of the native bees are particularly attracted to salvias, especially blue, purple, some of the reds, and even at home my wife's now planting salvias and that to attract the native bees to home, which we're now getting.
Yes, I've noticed the native bee, particularly the blue banded bee, really likes liriope at my place, so even though they're native, they do visit the exotics as well. Are there any particular plants apart from the salvias that you'd always be looking for insects?
From my point of view, I'm not a botanist. I don't know very many of the plants or what they're called, but just the flowering plants are mainly the ones that we look for. Even the small, what are they, gardenias or whatever, Paul? and we find spiders on those. And also with the hoverflies flying around in those, the spiders are sort of sitting in wait for them, for the hoverfly to land, and next minute the spider's pounced on the hoverfly and makes a great photo. Poor old hoverfly doesn't last long though.
In the sensory garden there's a lot of plectranthus plants with the lovely flowers, and we do find quite a few spiders get into those, especially the lynx spiders, which have lovely long hairy legs and photograph really, really well. And the rondeletia, when it flowers, the small trees, a lot of the hoverflies and bees will get into those as well. And there's a couple of those in the sensory garden as well. But our first point of call when we do a macro photography shoot is straight into the sensory garden and into the area where the salvias are, because they just flower basically all year. And there's always something in there.
So can you give some tips for people who might be walking to the gardens and they're armed with their phone and they'd like to see if they could get an insect with their macro mode? What should they be looking for? How do they're obviously not going to want to turn every leaf over and try to find an insect. Can you see some sort of larger clues which makes you go, oh, I'm going to go over there?
We sort of know areas to visit, which is good. But the best thing with macro photography is just take your time, and if you're in an area like the sensory garden where there are lots and lots of flowering plants, just stand and watch, because after a while your eye will pick up movement or a colour that doesn't look quite right, shouldn't be there, and often they're spiders or insects that you haven't seen at first glance, but because you've taken your time you will actually see them. And especially things like native bees that fly very, very, very quickly, you'll see something move and it might suddenly disappear, but a few minutes later it'll come back again, back to the flowers. So the best thing is to do is just take your time and just look carefully, but take your time. That's the secret. You don't rush through, because you'll miss everything.
Relax and enjoy the scenery.
Yeah, which is easy to do at the gardens.
It certainly is. But like Paul, nowadays all I can do is rely on something that moves. If it moves, I'll see it. If it doesn't move, I'll leave Paul to find it.
And what sort of time of day should people be trying?
In summer, we tend to get there 7 o'clock. The gardens may not be open, but there are other areas of the gardens you can go to, like the display ponds at the administration building, the Australian rainforest on your right-hand side as you drive in. You can access those areas early in the morning. But in winter, hey Kev, a little bit later in the day, we usually start around 8 o'clock. So, and even then, it may be a little bit early for some of the insects that like to warm up a bit.
Yes, a bit like us.
But if they're cool, they move slower.
Okay, yes. So they might... Might be merited so going
is,
early.
It is a bit of merit if it's a little cool.
In the morning. Yeah.
And when do you get a bit of dew on the leaves and everything like that? You find grasshoppers and katydids and all those sort of things that are sitting on the leaf with dewdrops on them, and they make really, really excellent subjects. You get the lighting just right and the position right and the composition right, and you at the end of the shoot you go, wow, there's number one shot. That's it for the day. And you go away pretty pleased. If you get one really good shot for the day, you can't ask for any more.
I started my macro photography taking fungi, which is very easy to get a nice composition, because you just sit with your mushroom for 10 minutes and adjust your camera and there you're done, because it's not moving. And the transition to going to take an insect, it's a different set of skills, having to be quick and working out how to capture the movement. What I have found, though, with the insects, which is really great fun, is what personality they have. And once you start to see the insects blown up, you can see all sorts of patterns in them and beautiful colours. And we're going to put some of Kev and Paul's photos on our Facebook page and also on our website page, so you can have a look. And you can see just how... what great characters these spiders and insects are. Have you got tips for people about how you actually can turn a spider or an insect into a Mona Lisa? What have you got to do? I mean, obviously, unless it's got a fascinating rear end, you don't want to take from that angle.
I always, and Kev would do the same, focus on the eye of the insect. I will discard a photo if the eye is not in focus, because that is basically the whole insect is the eye. If that's in focus, it looks good. If it's not in focus, it doesn't look good. And we tend to use a fairly small focus point. So if you're using something like a phone, you know how you can touch the screen to get your focus mm-hmm. point. So if you've got an insect and you're trying to do it with a phone, put your focus point over the insect's head if you have time, and that will tend to focus in that area. Some of the insect may be out of focus, but that's normal with macro photography because your depth of field is really short, it's really narrow.
Yes. So can you explain depth of field for people?
Yeah, depth of field means how much of your subject is going to be in focus. So because we don't do what we call focus stacking, we only do one single shot. We don't do multiple shots and then join them together, which you can do if the subject's stationary. Because our subjects move, some of the insect, unless you're doing a side-on shot or an above shot, will be out of focus. But I always aim for the eye, and the main part of the insect will be in focus, and that's what I usually look for. And you do something similar, Kev?
Yeah, the main focus point is the eye of the subject, the closest eye to you. If you set your camera up properly with the right aperture and shutter speed and your flash is working right so you get the nice diffused image, you'll end up with a reasonably good depth of field in the subject, and that's what attracts the people. But you have to have that eye in focus. That's the same as if I'm looking at you and talking to you. I'm looking at you in the eyes. It's exactly the same with an insect. When somebody's viewing that insect after you've taken the photo, they're looking at the eye of the insect. And if that's in focus, that captures their imagination.
We've talked about what a great variety of spiders and insects there are in the gardens. Which ones are standouts for you?
We both love the jumping spiders because they're real characters, lovely eight eyes, often very hairy bodies, a variety of colours, and they're just really colourful characters. If you look at Kev's T-shirt, you can see a lovely jumping spider as Kev's logo for his diffusers. So we all love jumping spiders. They're just such characters in preference to spiders that are just sitting in webs.
And what about the native bees? Are there so many different types of native bees? Are there particular ones that you see most in the gardens?
Yeah, there's about 1,600 to 2,000 species of native bees, some of which haven't even been named yet, I've heard. But the ones we see the most are the blue-bandeds, leafcutter bees, teddy bear bees, very occasionally a neon cuckoo bee or something like that. But a lot of those are probably the most common ones we see, aren't they, Kev, those sort of three species?
Yeah, them are the little native stingless bee.
Oh, the native stingless,
the Tetragonula carbonaria.
Tetragonula carbonaria, because they have the hive in the sensory garden in the log there. And they're an interesting little bee. A bit difficult to photograph because they're so tiny and they're such a dark colour that often it's hard to get a nice photo of them.
Yeah, because they're jet black.
Jet black.
And they're shiny as well, so it makes it hard to get a good photo that's not blown out. Yeah. So your lighting has to be just right for those, otherwise it's a waste of time.
If they have big pollen sacs on their legs, that helps. You get that orange or white contrast to the black body. Yeah. But they are difficult to photograph.
So you've got the black ones, and then you mentioned the neon cuckoo bee, which doesn't sound like it's black at all.
Oh, it is.
It's black, it is? With blue,
black with blue,
iridescent blue spots.
Oh, wow.
That's a beautiful bee. A little difficult to photograph because of the shiny black. You've got to get your lighting just right, and very elusive. I've seen them a few times. I've got two nice photographs a little while back of one, which has been on my bucket list for years. Finally got some.
And it's a great name. And the other name, I haven't seen one, but I've heard you two talk about, the banana stalk fly. Where does that name come from?
They usually live on the banana stalks.
Oh, okay. So are you seeing those in the gardens?
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereabouts do you see them?
Oh, they're everywhere, aren't they?
Well, yeah. What are those plants on the zigzag track, Paul?
On the heliconias. Yes. You see them sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, we get them on there quite often. Yeah,
they're often on a variety of plants, though. We do see them on the heliconias,
yeah.
On the little pathway from the information centre down towards the lagoon.
Ah, yes.
We call it the zigzag path. Yeah.
Yes. Well, it does zigzag, it is doesn't zigzag. It, down yeah. there. It's a nice path. It's yeah. part of the nice new addition with the new visitor centre. So what am I going to be looking for to know that it's a banana stalk fly?
Long legs.
Long legs. They're long very, legs. Very tiny.
Small body, long legs.
Long legs.
With yeah. a pointy nose. It seems to sit up in the air.
Yeah. If you're not sure if you've got one, you probably need to look it up on the internet and,
yes.
and ID it that way. Yeah.
Yes. Well, yeah. it's very easy now, isn't yeah. it, to run your photo yeah. through
Mr.
something.
Mr. Google's right. Sometimes.
You've been going to the gardens for many years looking at insects. What have you noticed about any changes of populations of insects?
Over the years, there's definitely been a large decline in the number of insects, and I think Kev and I have noticed in the last 2 or 3 years a substantial decline in the number of insects in the gardens. I think it's a worldwide phenomenon, but we have really noticed that it takes us now longer to find things. We don't have the variety of insects that we used to see, and it's just getting harder to do what we have done in the past, and it just takes longer to find things, doesn't it, Kev?
Yeah, it's been pretty tough looking for insects, even though I don't see too many, but normally I find them with just by looking and movement and stuff like that, but nowadays there's not as many insects around as there has been in the past.
Are there any particular species you've noticed aren't there now?
I've noticed. My particular favourite insect is the katydid, which, to the people who don't know what they look very similar to a grasshopper, but they often have lovely colours, especially when they're juveniles. And it's just hard to find them now. I can go out on a shoot and not see any at all. I think I saw one on my last shoot, and that was it. It was an adult. So those insects, native bees, not as many around as there used to be. What do you think? Any others you've noticed, Kev?
Native bees in particular, like bees. The blue banders and the teddy bear bees.
Teddy bear bees, yeah.
Very few and far between nowadays.
And the big carpenter bees, you don't see many yep. of those now. They're a very large bee. People often mistake them for a bumblebee, but we don't have bumblebees on the mainland. And just don't see as many as we used to.
Yeah. 3 years ago, I used to take photos of bumblebees, teddy bear bees and blue banded bees on the zigzag track, and you'd be lucky to see them there at the moment. You would never see one there anymore.
So I'm just wondering whether, you know, it's because it seems to be a worldwide phenomenon, whether it's the use of pesticides, climate change, because it's just so much hotter now, and some days in the botanic gardens it's just so hot. I'm wondering whether that's not affecting the insects, whether they just can't survive the heat. Yes. Some days in there it's just really hot, yeah.
Yeah, but it's just, there is a definite drop-off in the insect numbers, Paul, isn't there?
Definitely, yeah.
Which makes it really important to stop and take some time to look at them.
Take some time and look
That's
at
it.
Them.
Yeah.
And if people can plant flowering plants in their gardens, that helps.
Yes, yes.
Gives them somewhere to live.
From what you've been saying, you know, you're lingering in the gardens, aren't you? You're not rushing.
Oh no.
Take it easy. That's all you've got to do. Just take your time. Move slowly.
Yeah.
If you're doing photography, you've got to move slowly because any sudden movement's going to scare the insect off. Yeah. So just take your time, relax, enjoy yourself.
And don't like Kev said, don't move quickly. If you're going to take a photo of an insect in your excitement, don't move your hands quickly or your camera quickly or the insect will go. You've got to just do it very gently. Yeah. And we can spend 2 or 3 hours in the gardens and walk 200 metres.
Yes, yes. So you're really getting to know the gardens quite intimately with all that time and looking at them very, very closely.
We're exploring new areas all the time. We just suddenly realised that there's more down at the Japanese gardens to see than what we thought.
So what have you originally thought that when you get there, that it's just a very well-pruned place in some regards, and it looks beautiful from afar, doesn't it? It's very picturesque. But now that you're looking closely and uncovering, you're discovering a whole new little world of small things.
There's still areas that we have that we don't go to that we should go to. I went to the gardens one day and met up with a friend of mine, Dominic Dell, and he took me up to an area. I was pretty puffed by the time we got there, but it was an area I hadn't been to. I've only been there the once, and the bees up there were just amazing. They were just blue banded and teddy bear bees all over the place up there.
Could be the plants for Brisbane area up near the Second Lake.
They're right up the top past the Century Gardens. Right up the top of the roads.
Australian plant community up into there probably. By the sound of it,
It's a fabulous area.
So of all these different areas, what is your favourite part of the gardens then, Kev?
Japanese gardens.
And why is that? Is that based on macro or just from the gardens?
The atmosphere there. It's a fabulous atmosphere, the running creeks, the plants that are there, and just recently, the insects that we've been finding there as well, which have been quite different to what we've been finding elsewhere.
Yes. And Paul, what about you? Well, what's your favourite part?
Putting the macro photography aside, the exotic rainforest, I always find that really peaceful and calming in there. And when I was an education officer and we had to go out for about an hour before our lessons and plan our lessons and check that the routes we were taking the students and everything was all clear, no sprinklers on, that sort of thing. I, especially in a winter's morning, I always found the exotic rainforest just lovely and relaxing and peaceful and calm. Just near the Roxburgh fig there on the corner, if you know the plant, just sitting in there, it's just lovely while I was getting organised for the day. Because a lot of our lessons took place in that part of the gardens because it's close to where the students arrive.
Yes,
but it is a lovely part of the garden.
And it's a nice cool part, even on the hottest days. Yeah. It's delightful.
Still
there.
A bit cooler on a hot day.
I was walking around there recently with some members of the Friends of the Gardens because on the last Sunday of the month we do a little exploratory walk where we go to a part of the gardens. And we don't go far, a bit like the macro photographers. We just really look at a small part and walk around. And we're going around the paths of the exotic rainforest. And there are a few of us who have actually visited the gardens for many years and we're remarking that you can go a different way every time. And you sort of wonder, is this a new route I've taken? And Paul, which reminds me, I think you've said something about they were designed that way.
Ray, who used to be a volunteer guide, I was talking to him one day many years ago and he was instrumental in designing the gardens. He was quite involved in it. And he said, the gardens were designed to get lost in.
Yes.
Because there are pathways everywhere.
Yes.
And as an education officer, sometimes I would actually be out planning a lesson or I'd be out with a group of students and there'd be a couple of visitors from overseas looking very sort of lost and I'd say, can I help you? And they'd say, how do you get out? And I would show them the pathway to get back to the main road and back to the information centre. Because there are pathways everywhere. And as Kev knows, you know, even though you've been there a heap, there's still pathways. Kev will say, how do we get out of here again?
Some of the pathways around the Japanese gardens to go up to the planetarium or whatever, there's tracks everywhere.
Yes,
but they all end up at the same place. But it's just there's so many different type varieties of plants and everything on every different track. It's pretty an amazing place.
Yeah. Well, it's just great to hear when you are such long term visitors to the gardens and you spend hours in there and you're still finding new things to see.
Yeah, we do new areas to explore and areas you don't think of, and then there's something in there and you think, oh, okay, we'll come back here again next time, because you don't realise it's there. I suppose 56 hectares is a lot to explore.
Yes, particularly when you're going insect by insect.
Insect by insect, plant by plant,
Well, Paul and Kev, it's been fabulous having you talk about the insects, the small things to find in the gardens. And I'm sure you've inspired us all to, next time we go, to look at things a bit more closely, to slow down, stop, look for the movement, try to get lost in the exotic rainforest, and also, once again, take in the lovely ambience of the Japanese garden, but keep an eye out for the small things there too.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. And I think that's going to be great, even for people who aren't photographers at all. There's always something to be found there. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah.
Lovely to have you with us.
And we love to have people come up to us while we're doing our photography and ask us what we're doing. And we tell them and show them.
Yeah, we get so many overseas tourists coming. What are you doing? You show them on the back of the camera and they go, oh, wow, what's that?
So make sure you check out Kevin Paul's photos, which we'll have on our Facebook page and also on our website. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And thank you also to the Brisbane Lord Mayor's Community Fund, Councillor Greg Adaman, and the Brisbane City Council Libraries for supporting our podcasts. Join us for our next episode and we'll continue celebrating the 50th anniversary of the opening of Brisbane Botanic Gardens, Mount Coot-tha.